home births, physical stress and communication, compression-only CPR, and we're going to take a look at toxic gases. If that's what you're looking for, if you found it, it's The Nursing Show. Well, good day and welcome to this week's episode of The Nursing Show. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, and I'm here to welcome you again to another episode, episode 102 of The Nursing Show. And we are going to have a lot to discuss in this week's episode, but I wanted to remind you that you can find information, links, and additional resources for this episode over at nursingshow.com in the show notes category there, RN Podcasts. Also in the podcast category or the categories there, you might want to check out Nursing Show TV. I've posted several videos over the last week, and we'll have a few more coming in the coming week to show you some of the med bloggers and medical podcasters I met while at Blog World Expo last week. And it's a great opportunity to maybe see some of your med bloggers face-to-face, so to speak, and to see exactly what kind of fun folks they really are. I really can't say enough how good a time I had talking with and meeting for the first time face-to-face Dr. Anonymous. I talked to Kim from the Emergent blog. I met Gina from the Code blog. Let's see, Nurse Ratched's place, Terry over there. I met Dr. Wes and Dr. Rob. I met Bongi from South Africa. He's a surgeon blogger from down there. Just a ton of great people. And thanks to the people who sponsored the Med Blogger track, Johnson & Johnson. And so we want to maybe if you're a med blogger, a nurse blogger listening to this, or a nursing student blogger, you know, if there's a way, we'd like to get you out there next year so that you can participate in some of the great discussions we had and see all the great stuff and bring back some swag from the expo hall too. All available over at the Blog World Expo. But check out the videos and see some of the fun we had while we were out there. And you'll find those posted over at nursingshow.com in the Nursing Show TV category. Also, don't forget, if you have any comments or suggestions, corrections even, that you'd like to share back with me and the other listeners, please send them in to the email address comments@nursingshow.com. comments@nursingshow.com. It's great to hear from all of you, and it's an opportunity for each and every one of you to talk back to the show and let me know what you want to see in future episodes, or to make sure that the best information is presented to the Nursing Show community. And that's a job we all share together, really. It's something that we all need to do to make sure that the best information is presented here on the show. I do the best I can, but I'm going to miss some things from time to time, and it's an important for you, the listeners, to make this not just me talking, but really make it a discussion and give me some feedback. So please continue to do that. Also, we are conducting a survey right now of listeners, and this is not just the Nursing Show. This is a national podcast listener survey. So you can really help out the Nursing Show or whichever podcast you might listen to by going over and checking out the survey. Now you can find that at this link, takethesurvey.com/rawvoice, RAWVOICE, takethesurvey.com/rawvoice. There'll be a link in the show notes, but this is only going to be available for a couple of weeks, but we really want to get an idea of who you, the podcast listeners, are. Now, there's no collection of any personal information there. This is really just an opportunity for you to spend 5 or 10 minutes going over and just quickly filling out that survey for us. Help tell the podcasters out there who you are as an audience, and enable us to better provide good podcasts and good material for you. And because our shows are all so very different, it's really important that each show and each group of listeners participates in this survey. So again, takethesurvey.com /raw voice. Do that right away when you get a chance in front of a computer. Take a few minutes. They told me it would take up to 10 minutes to get the survey done, but I think it's very valuable and very important. We don't do these surveys very often here on The Nursing Show, so it's an important way for you to help give back to the show and participate nationally in supporting podcasts. Time to jump on into this week's news, and let me hold on a second. I've got to put on my helmet and my protective gear here, because I'll tell you what, I'm about to open the can of worms again. And this is because I found a USA Today article featured over at medicalnewstoday.com talking about the safety and risks associated with home births. I'm cringing. Okay. This has been one of those topics that always tends to bring out a lot of comment, and I welcome those comments because, you know, I am not first of all, I'm not a labor and delivery nurse. I'm not a certified nurse midwife, I'm a supporter of home births, but I think that there are always two sides to these pictures, and because I have a background in emergency services, you know, nobody wants to roll up on a call where you have an at-risk pregnancy and a preterm birth or a home birth that is not prepared. So we want to, you know, try to err on the side of caution in these situations, but how far do we err? And that's what this article looks at today, the debate over the safety of these home births. A percentage of home births, according to this article, has dropped precipitously. Less than 1% of the births in the United States happen at home. And you compare that to other countries, and the article talks about Dutch births, and in Holland, births are 30% in the Netherlands in the home. And certainly they are close to healthcare facilities in Europe, more densely packed population, but yet there's not the need felt when there's the presence of a certified midwife in the home for uncomplicated and non-risk, high-risk pregnancies. However, the other side of that picture is there's a lot of opposition to this in the United States, and of course coming mainly from the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists campaigning against home births, and of course the American Medical Association. They have stated that there is a lot of safety concerns, and you know, nobody's saying that people that have high-risk pregnancies should be having home births, but for people that have had completely normal pregnancies, I live in the central mid-Atlantic area, and I actually live very near large Amish communities that have many, many home births. And in many cases, a lot of those pregnancies would be considered high risk in other communities, but it's something that they do quite frequently. And I think that this is something we need to approach. It was said to me early on, and not even in my nursing training, but in my EMT and paramedic training years ago, that, you know, pregnancy is not a disease. It is, in fact, a natural process, and that, you know, if it was such a hugely dangerous thing, there would be no humans on the planet. And I think that that gives you a little bit of a good perspective on this topic. I know I'm preaching to the choir here, but I really want to hear back comments from nurse midwives on appropriate actions, appropriate times and inappropriate times for home-based births, and what we can do to encourage more practices of home-based births. It certainly would go a long way towards reducing the cost associated with childbirth. Let's move from a look at the healthcare in the Netherlands to a study that came out of Sweden looking at some of the strain on caregivers associated with care of a dementia patient. We've talked about delirium and dementia in recent episodes here at The Nursing Show, but we understand also how physically draining that can be on caregivers. But is that because they have to do lots of lifting? We have to do lifts, or in a home care situation, family members or other caregivers are doing a lot of lifts or other care? Is that what's causing the physical strain? According to this study, it's not. That it actually is, some of that strain is actually physical stress physiologically on the body associated with communication difficulties and anxiety associated with trying to work with and communicate and make sense to a person who is suffering from dementia. And this is something that is very frustrating. I know many of you have dealt with patients with dementia or delirium. It becomes very frustrating. It's like talking to, in some cases, a toddler, sometimes even worse. You cannot reason with them. You can't make them understand because for whatever reason, they lack the ability to cognitively make the leap on what you're trying to tell them. And this can become extremely frustrating and require additional mental and physical resources to stand there and continue to try to make a point and be patient. And of course, that puts physical stress on the systems because it causes increased anxiety, increases the sympathetic nervous system response, and can lead to its own whole host of issues associated with that prolonged stressful situation. So clearly, understanding this can help with some of the battle, but it doesn't alleviate it for many caregivers who are really in place 24/7 with very little or no relief. And so we need to find ways, if we are caring for these families, and I do see it not just caring for the patient, but caring for their care system, that we need to find ways to continue to provide support for the family and caregivers, not just for the patient themselves. And of course, this is going to require some really clever nursing care and nursing interventions so that we can make sure that they're getting that support and we can provide it in a timely and cost-effective fashion. Finally, my last story, talking about uninterrupted chest compressions and compression-only CPR as an out-of-hospital, bystander-supported cardiac arrest survival technique. This is something that I've addressed over at my other show, The MedicCast, but I don't think I've talked about it too much here because we don't talk about out-of-hospital CPR very often in the nursing show or nursing setting at all. It's very common to discuss these things on an EMS-related show. But I think it's important for us to understand that there are more and more studies showing that if we have a patient that has had a witnessed cardiac arrest, that jumping in there and starting chest compressions immediately, you know, going through the process of assessing for responsiveness, opening the airway, supplying breaths, and then going on and doing compressions, well, that they say check for responsiveness and then jump right into providing compressions. It does a couple of things. It alleviates the concern of bystanders of having to do mouth-to-mouth resuscitation. Most of them are not going to have some kind of a barrier device in their wallet or their purse. You also have the advantage of the fact that if this is a witnessed arrest, jumping in there and doing chest compressions immediately, once you've assessed for responsiveness, these patients were breathing seconds ago. So in this situation, there's probably oxygen present in the lungs, and if we can continue to circulate blood, we can provide that oxygen a place to go and continue to maintain perfusion, at least to the vital organs, with good, high-quality, uninterrupted chest compressions. Now, that said, you should follow your protocols and guidelines, but this is something that many dispatch centers across the United States are making as part of their instructions to callers on not worrying about the airway portion of CPR and just providing chest compressions until professional rescuers arrive. And I thought it was important for you to hear a little bit about how that process is moving along, since you may have cardiac patients or home care patients to whom you are providing assistance for both them and their families. Time for this week's Tip and Trick of the Week, and we're joined again by our good friend Lisa Booz from the Maryland Poison Center. You can find her programs at mdpoison.com. She has a great resource of the Tox Tidbits email newsletter and some other resources she has available there, so visit her over at mdpoison.com. You don't have to be from the state of Maryland. She provides that information out there to anybody, so just sign up and get access to it. Lisa's joining us today, and she's going to be talking about toxic gases. So this is a segment recorded earlier, and we'll jump right on into that. This is Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, and it's time again for another Tox Tidbits segment with our good friend Lisa Booz from the Maryland Poison Center. Lisa, how are you today?
Fine, thanks, Jamie. How are you?
Oh, we're doing just fine. I'm looking forward to what you have for us this week. Because it's been a while since we've talked, but I know you've got a couple of good topics coming up in the next few months.
That's right. I think that these topics will be interesting to your listeners. It's a variety of topics touching on a variety of different things that we're seeing at the Poison Center. The first one this month I'd like to go over are toxic gases. Now, most of the poisonings that are reported to poison centers are ingestions, but we also get some exposures that are dermal exposures or eye exposures, and then occasionally we do get calls about the inhalation of certain types of gases. So I thought I'd review some of the toxicity of these gases. Now, the gases are broken down into several different groups depending on how toxic they are and what types of toxicity you see. And the first group are what we call simple asphyxiants. Now, these are gases that really are not toxic in the true sense of the word, but they displace oxygen from air in enclosed spaces like a room, and that leads to hypoxia. You know, you're just not breathing in enough oxygen, enough air. Gases that are simple asphyxiants include methane, which is natural gas, butane, helium, and propane. And then there's also carbon dioxide, which is dry ice, and nitrogen. Now, both of those gases do have some physiologic effects, but most of the poisonings with those gases produce hypoxic effects just like the other simple asphyxiants. Now, when somebody breathes too much of this gas in, or basically it's not so much they're breathing too much of the gas but not enough oxygen, they develop certain symptoms like an increase in respiratory rate, their heart rate goes up, they have decreased visual acuity, their mental status is altered, and then that's all followed by hyperventilation or almost like an air hunger type of response, confusion, numbness, and memory loss. They can become cyanotic, they can lose consciousness, and they can also have seizures. Treatment for these exposures consists of basically just removing the patient from that enclosed space so that they can get some air. And in some cases, 100% oxygen with assisted ventilation and other supportive care is needed. Another group of gases are what we call pulmonary irritants. Now, these gases affect the mucosa in the respiratory tract. People who inhale these types of gases usually develop symptoms within seconds, especially with pulmonary irritants that are considered very or highly water-soluble gases, and that would include gases like ammonia, sulfur dioxide, and chloramine. And in case you don't know, chloramine is actually the gas that's produced when ammonia is mixed with bleach. And we get a lot of people who do that. They want to make a better cleaner by mixing the two together, and then chloramine is released from that mixture. Patients usually complain of eye irritation, nose irritation, mouth and throat irritation, and they'll be coughing a lot too. Gases that are less water-soluble, like chlorine and another gas called phosgene, will produce only mild symptoms at first in some cases, but they're more likely to affect the lower airway. Now, calls to poison centers involving chlorine gas are usually from people who work with chemicals at swimming pools or people who mix bleach with a strong acid in a product like a toilet bowl cleaner. Phosgene is a gas that's used or released in the manufacturing of chemicals and products such as insecticides and a whole variety of different chemicals. It has an odor of freshly cut hay or grass that's pretty noticeable. When inhaled, it reacts with water in the lungs and it actually produces hydrochloric acid, so you can imagine how irritating that might be. You will sometimes get delayed effects like bronchitis, bronchospasm, and acute lung injury with any of the pulmonary irritant gases, but especially with those that aren't very water-soluble like chlorine and phosgene. Now, there's another group of gases that produce systemic toxicity, and some examples of those gases would be carbon monoxide, hydrogen cyanide, and hydrogen sulfide. They all act by decreasing either the delivery of or the utilization of oxygen. carbon monoxide, as most of your listeners know, is a leading cause of poisoning, morbidity, and mortality in the United States. There are more than 2,000 non-fire-related fatalities and more than 5,000 fire-related mortalities or fatalities that are related to carbon monoxide inhalations each year. Carbon monoxide works by binding hemoglobin in the blood, and it produces something called carboxyhemoglobin, and that combination there makes the hemoglobin unable to carry oxygen to tissues. So the first symptoms that you notice following a carbon monoxide exposure are headache, dizziness, and nausea. And patients are often and can easily be misdiagnosed as having the flu. If the exposure continues or if it's a pretty high concentration of carbon monoxide, they'll also develop blurred vision. They may become pretty lethargic. They may have an increase in their respiratory rate. They develop a metabolic acidosis, and they can also have arrhythmias. People who die from carbon monoxide exposures usually die due to ventricular arrhythmias and cardiac arrest. Now, carbon monoxide also has a more of a direct toxic effect, and so it can also cause some delayed neurologic effects. People will develop dementia, psychosis, and even amnesia, and they can develop anywhere from about 2 to 40 days after the exposure. Treatment of carbon monoxide exposures is 100% oxygen, and also hyperbaric oxygen is used for those with severe symptoms, those who are at risk for delayed neurologic effects, and also we have a pretty low threshold for hyperbaric oxygen therapy in pregnant women. The fetus has an increased risk due to carbon monoxide than even the mother does. Another gas is hydrogen cyanide. Hydrogen cyanide is generated in closed space fires, and we now know that it's a major contributing factor in smoke inhalation deaths, not just carbon monoxide. Usually there's a combination of the two. The cyanide inhibits cellular respiration. It actually binds to an enzyme that's called cytochrome oxidase. Symptoms usually occur really rapidly, often within seconds, and patients will become weak, maybe confused, their respiratory rate increases, they have bradycardia, hypertension, seizures, and coma, and then that's followed by a slowing of respiratory rate, hypotension, and tachycardia. Now, when patients are in the hospital, it's really difficult to get blood cyanide levels. It takes a while. It's usually a send out for most hospitals. And so the diagnosis of the cyanide poisoning is usually made when lab results show that the patient has a metabolic acidosis and an increase in lactic acid levels. Treatment consists of 100% oxygen, and there are various antidotes that can be given. Now, for years, we've given a three-step cyanide antidote kit that consists of amyl nitrite, sodium nitrite, and sodium thiosulfate. And those chemicals, those three antidotes, actually bind cyanide and then ultimately convert it to a non-toxic compound. Now, the problem is when the nitrites are given in the presence of carbon monoxide poisoning, such as in a smoke inhalation case, the oxygen-carrying capacity of hemoglobin is reduced even more, so it can actually make things worse for that patient. So fortunately now there's another antidote that's called hydroxocobalamin. The brand name is CyanoKit, and that's safe to use in smoke inhalation patients. It converts cyanide to cyanocobalamin, and that actually is another name for vitamin B12. So it converts cyanide to a vitamin, and that vitamin is non-toxic. Now another gas is hydrogen sulfide. It's a highly toxic gas. It's released from degrading protein waste such as manure and sewage. It's also a byproduct in petroleum and natural gas industries as well as some other industries. It inhibits the same enzyme as hydrogen cyanide does, and so it also causes cellular hypoxia. It does have, because it's a sulfur-containing compound, it has a characteristic rotten egg odor, but with high concentrations, you really lose that ability to smell that rotten egg odor pretty quickly. You just don't smell it at all at that point. Symptoms that patients get are nausea, vomiting, confusion, changes in their heart rate and blood pressure can really go up or down either way, and dysrhythmias. And victims will collapse suddenly. It has what's called a knockdown effect in high concentrations with respiratory paralysis and seizures. Unlike cyanide or hydrogen cyanide, if a patient's removed promptly from the area, complete recovery might occur. However, in some cases, other types of therapy might be needed, such as 100% oxygen and anecdotal therapy with sodium nitrite, maybe hyperbaric oxygen. And actually, we're unsure about this, but there might be some use for hydroxycobalamin with hydrogen sulfide exposures. We just don't know. There's not enough known about it yet in those situations. EMS providers should be aware that recently we've heard about some suicides across the United States and even here in Maryland from hydrogen sulfide inhalation when products containing sulfur are mixed with products that contain strong acids. That releases hydrogen sulfide. And most people have been doing this in an enclosed area like a car. First responders should be on the lookout for product containers that might indicate that that's what's being done. There might be this rotten egg odor. And also coins either on the patient or around the patient might look very dark from the reaction to that gas. With all toxic gas exposures and healthcare providers, EMS providers, you really need to take all precautions necessary to protect yourself from the gases. That's extremely important, particularly with a gas exposure. And always call the National Poison Control Center number for advice for gas exposures. And that number is 1-800-222-1222.
Wow, Lisa, that's a fact-packed segment there, and a lot of information, but a lot of great information, and some things I really wasn't aware of. Does this have anything to do with the accumulation of gases that we see in farm silos? I know there was a recent episode in Pennsylvania nearby where there was a death in a silo. Is that similar? Is that any of these gases responsible for that, or is that?
Yeah, it's actually a different gas that's formed in the silos. There's various other things that can happen with filling silos, but there is another gas that's formed in that case. It's a little bit different in toxicity, but certainly the symptoms would be very similar to what you see with some of these gases like the hydrogen cyanide and whatnot, and it can also have a pretty rapid onset of effect in people who are in those areas.
Great. Well, Lisa, thank you for sharing this information, and we'll look forward to what you have for us next month.
Thanks, Jamie.
And that's going to wrap up this week's episode of The Nursing Show. I want to remind everybody that you need to check back in for the show notes for everything discussed in this episode. All of the news items, tip files, and other links mentioned are all available in the show notes for this and every other episode. And you need to follow up on the information because I can provide only general information here. It's your job to follow the links and look at the resources and see how they apply to your own scope of practice. I'll do my job here and get you as much information as I can. It's your job to follow up, make sure that the information gels with what you know and what you're supposed to be doing in your area. I'd like to urge all of you to comment and get back in touch with me here at The Nursing Show. You can reach me, of course, by leaving comments over at nursingshow.com. There are comment links at the bottom or near the top of every single article. You can also reach me by email, comments@nursingshow.com. And you can also get a hold of me over at Facebook, facebook.com/podmedic, or you can follow me on Twitter, twitter.com/podmedic. Don't forget to fill out that survey. Again, take the survey.com/rawvoice, RAWVOICE, and that will get you that survey. Please take the time and let us know a little bit about you, the podcast listener. That's it for me. Closing out with some music from the PodSafe Music Network at music.podshow.com. This is Laura Clapp and her song, I'm Not Responsible. Of course, I am responsible. This is my show, after all. But I want to hear from all of you. Keep in touch. And in the meantime, please remember to stay safe and stay tuned here to The Nursing Show. Take care. Thank you.
Won't you wrap your guilt around me when you don't get your way? And you bleed all this blame. Clean your cut, wrap it up, take care of your own pain. 'Cause it's you, not me, who's gonna set you free. And I'm sorry, but I don't have the time. And it's me, not you, that ends up feeling used. And I'm sorry, baby, but I'm not responsible. Why can't you let it go? Oh, yeah. 'Cause all that you're crying about happened 2 years ago or more. You hit rock bottom, now you're pacing its floor. But what I'm talking about is climbing out. Well, no one's help but your own. 'Cause it's you, not me, who's gonna set you free. And I'm sorry, but I don't have the time. And it's me, not you, that ends up feeling used. And I'm sorry, baby, but I'm not responsible. Grow some backbone, stand up for yourself. 'Cause I ain't taking no more, and neither is no one else. I'm not responsible.